So this time of year, you know, every October we do an introductory series on the foundations of mindfulness and the practice of insight of Vipassana meditation. And then customarily we follow that with some inquiry into another of the companion practices in Theravada Buddhism, which is the cultivation of certain qualities of mind, in particular the qualities of compassion, selfless joy, equanimity, and open-heartedness, collectively known in this tradition as the Brahma Viharas, or the four immeasurables, the divine abodes, or sometimes as collectively as the practice of metta, or loving-kindness. And one of the reasons I usually do this is because it provides some grounding in the sort of the similarities or touch points between this tradition and those similar qualities that are emphasized a lot as the, especially the Christian holidays roll around. But at the same time, for me, and then this is, you know, really sort of a rather personal talk, I guess, at around the same time of year when I'm kind of inclining the attention and the mind to kind of renewing my own commitment to the cultivation of these qualities as a less self-centered way to guide my life and to also teach those. It's also the same time of year that usually, or at least often, arises for me is particularly strong resistance to doing so. And in fact, truth be told, around this time of year, what commonly arises for me is strong disgust and revulsion with the arrival of the holiday season. Primarily having to do with its relentless commercialism. Also, it's around the time that Veterans Day rolls around, and I don't know, it's being a veteran, it's always a little awkward when somebody wishes me a happy Veterans Day. Usually, you know, if you can just say something like, thank you for your service, you know, may you be well, that's usually a little more fitting, you know, if the occasion arises. So how to deal with this, or at least, is there anyone else that, okay, good. Glad to hear I'm not the only one in the room right now. So, what can happen, certainly what happens for me sometimes, if I'm really focusing hard on really, you know, seeking to cultivate these qualities of mind, you know, the compassion and the joy and the equanimity and the open heart, and then I feel that resistance arising as I feel like I kind of ought to be trying a little harder even, and of course, then the resistance gets stronger. And then for me, what's useful to do and what I want to talk about this evening is examining this tension that arises between this image of how we ought to be, you know, because among other things, you know, this season is kind of saying that we need to be, and how in fact, you know, what my dharma is, dharma small d, in terms of my actual lived experience. And so when that tension becomes too great, what can happen is a certain amount of self-recrimination can arise for not, you know, really quite understanding this resistance or its strength or whatever. Maybe even a certain amount of loss of faith, either in oneself or in the path. And so what I've come to learn over the years is that it can be really helpful to have some pseudo-skillful means of blowing the stuff off. You know, of kind of just kind of getting it out of my system. of getting it out there and letting it run around and be crazy and kind of see it for what it is a little bit. You know, in that martial arts film, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, you know, the about the martial arts adept who becomes more and more powerful, but ultimately is at the expense of betraying one of her teachers. And so she was always aware of the enemy she could see. What she was never quite clear on was the one she couldn't see, which was her own ambition. And so this practice of, you know, the crouching tiger and the hidden dragon is this sort of unacknowledged resistance to the cultivation of some of these qualities of mind. So how to skillfully cultivate these qualities without being quite such a goody two-shoes, right? how to acknowledge and strengthen and encourage their coming forth while paying full and complete attention to the limitations and the resistances that arise when we do so, and coming to understanding and appreciating them a little more clearly. There's a Zen master named Kobenchino Roshi, who, at the request of Suzuki Roshi, who is abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, established the Tassajara Zen Center in the Ventana Wilderness in Big Sur in coastal California. And one of the classic texts in Mahayana Buddhism, certainly including the Zen tradition, is the Bodhisattva vow. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Desires are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. And so he traditionally taught the Bodhisattva vow for years, until at some point he realized that it seemed to be having the effect of sort of feeding the neuroses of the Zen students, you know, that you're sort of making matters worse, because all of us doing was pouring gasoline on the fires of relentless perfection. You know, that the constant striving for perfection, never being able to attain it. He said, you know, it's maybe a useful discipline in sort of the Japanese context and mostly in America, but he said every once in a while, you just gotta say, huh? And so this is his huh. Sentient beings are numberless. They will save themselves. Delusions are inexhaustible. They will end by themselves. Dharma gates are boundless. They will open continuously. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to allow it. So it's kind of an antidote. It's the expression of just letting go, you know. So instead of this sense of the need to drive oneself to attain this perfected state, it's basically to simply let it be. Just let it be. You know, the intention is a pure one and it's a wholesome one, but it's all too easy for that effort to become unskillful. And so as a result, sometimes it's really useful to just set aside, maybe even poke a little fun at it, lighten up, you know, trust that it will take care of itself over time. So, so what to do when these unwanted emotions or powerful thoughts and feelings come up that don't really comport with your idea of what it means to, you know, become a more complete bodhisattva, you know, a more pure in one's intentions and behavior. And of course, there's this famous poem on the topic by Rumi, the guest house. This being human is a guest house, every morning a new arrival. a joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent for a reason. So there are some Dharma teachers who even take it beyond that point. You know, Rumi's, the quality of Rumi's poem is about being a gracious host. You know, what in the Mahayana tradition is called, is referred to as the mind that contains all things and yet is not made up of them. You know, just that open spaciousness. So there are some Tibetan teachers, like Sultram Alioni, who says, well, you know, you can actually take it a step beyond that. She's got a little piece in the latest edition of The Inquiring Mind where she talks about that. She talks about actually sort of personifying your demons, giving them a name and a face and having conversations with them, and not just being a gracious host, but, you know, kind of getting down and partying hardy with them, and really let them come forward and do their thing, you know, let them rip. There's a really interesting teaching that was shared with me once by a Dharma teacher at Insight Meditation Center in Barrie. Her name was Michelle McDonald. So, and she's been a co-teacher on a lot of the 3-month retreats that have been held at IMS over the years. And on one retreat, in particular, there was, you know, an interview after interview after interview. So many of the yogis on retreat that were coming to speak with her were having real problems with a negative self-judgment and self-aversion and self-recrimination. And she would, you know, give sort of the traditional instruction, you know, that the purpose of being in this place of sanctuary, this place of refuge, is to simply allow these guests into the guest house, recognize them for what they are, let them arise and change and pass away, and hold the space with a compassionate heart to the extent that it's possible for you to do so. And so she would give that instruction and people would work with it, but for some it wasn't turning out to be so successful. So finally, in one Dharma talk, she said, you know, sometime the next day or two, for those of you that are having this issue, which evidently is about half the people on the retreat, said, set aside one sitting where you just let it rip. You know, if this voice that starts to come up with a particular kind of criticism, then give it a name and a face and give it a powerful voice and just listen to what it has to say, you know. And if it uses a loud voice and foul language, so be it, you know. Just freely engage in psychological self-abuse. Yeah. Just turn up the volume and let her rip. You know, all the things you're even afraid to think about yourself, okay, all the hidden suspicions, all the aspects of yourself that you don't really much care for, and these voices that come, and these phrases that, you know, and these attitudes that you, these ingrained in you, you know, that, and they may be associated with a stern teacher or a nun or a parent figure or something like that. But she said, just go ahead and go to the mat with it, okay, and give it completely free rein. And do this for as many sittings as you feel you need to in order to really clean yourself out. Basically, kind of an act of catharsis. Okay. So invite this stuff to come forward. You know, give me your best shot. You know, really see what's there. You know, listen to the words that are being said. Listen to the emotional force behind them. Okay. If they have a name, if they have a face, so much the better. It doesn't matter. Okay. Because the idea is to face the hidden dragon, is to just get right down to the root, like lancing a boil. She said, if you can do that, if you can, and of course this was in the space of a retreat, you know, a place of sanctuary with skilled teachers and whatnot. But she was saying, you know, if you can do this, just really, you know, get into a full rant about the whole thing, fully energize these despicable aspects of yourself, you can, you know, just, you know, you can hardly stand to be around, that at the end of the day, you will learn something. And who knows what it is that you may learn, okay? One of the things that some people learn from doing this is, you know, if I were in public and I heard a parent talking to a child that way, I would intervene. That's not acceptable. And if it's unacceptable for another, why do I talk to myself that way? That's a tricky one, because that, of course, can be fuel for further self-recrimination. But mostly what happens when there's that kind of insight is like, oh, you know, whatever misguided, you know, goal that recriminatory voice, that self-aversive energy is trying to achieve, it's not working, you know. Because at some gross and horribly misguided level, what that voice is often about is trying to browbeat you into being a spiritual person, right? It's the ego trying to browbeat us into being ego-free. And it doesn't have a friggin' clue. It doesn't know how to do that. It wants to be present for its own funeral, you know? It's completely clueless and completely ignorant of the process of spiritual maturation and the liberation of the heart-mind. Okay. And sometimes it takes letting it get out and run around to realize that it's kind of masquerading, you know? It's like, oh, you know, I'm smacking you around because it's good for you, right? Well, no, it's not. There is no upside to that at all, you know? If you can discern what might be something approximating skillful intent, but horribly, horribly manifests it, okay? Then in fact, by doing what Michelle advises, not every sitting, but every once in a while, okay, when it's lurking in the shadows, like the Buddha would, when the Buddha, that kind of energy arose in the Buddha's mind, you know, he gave it a name, Mara. He'd say, I see you, Mara, you know, hanging out in the shadows, you know, the shadow side, the hidden dragon, and said, come forth. Come forth out of the shadows. What do you have to tell me, you know? And sometimes doing that can actually be kind of helpful. So, yeah, in my own case, I find that before I can move forward, it's important for me to recognize the extent to which I perceive the kalesas, you know, the greed, hate, and fear that is extant in the world, that to some extent we all, you know, the aversion, attachment, delusion that we all hold within us. Sometimes it just feels a bit much, you know, and before I can fully allow the heart to open and accept, I have to sort of name the feelings that come up when I encounter these things. And so I'm going to give a little demo of that right now. It's somewhat self-effacing, but just if you just accept it for what it is, nothing more. First has to do with the extraordinary pervasiveness in greed in American culture and American social and intellectual history. Leading up to the present day, it's not something that just happened overnight or an artifact of the advertising industry. Alexis de Tocqueville, when he was visiting here in the United States in the 1820s, and then wrote his famous book, Democracy in America, that was published in 1835. We tend to most often repeat the phrases and the thoughts and the texts in his book that are most flattering to our country, you know, the things he really admired about the United States. And not so much the things that he basically warned us about, okay? And he said, I see two powerful forces at work in American society that if they are not brought sufficiently under control, will destroy this nation before it has a chance to reach its potential. One is unrestrained, unrelenting greed, and the other one was slavery. This is in 1835 that it came out. Unbridled greed.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And about the first one, he wrote this. In America, I have seen the freest and best educated of men in the happiest of circumstances the world can afford. Yet it appeared to me that a cloud hung on their brow, and they appeared serious and almost sad, even when they were enjoying themselves, because they never stopped thinking about the good things they have not yet got. Kabong! You know, just kind of nailed it. And, you know, and that's an artifact of how we got started as a country in the first place. It was all the folks coming over, the, you know, the European colonists who could never hope to own their own land or anything in the old country. But once they got here, they were absolutely, you know, fixated on getting their own real estate and their own, you know, getting their own place, their own situation set up to own something they'd never been able to own before. And so this lust for ownership, for grasping that which they had not previously had an opportunity to, very deeply woven into the American psyche. It's part of our karma, it's part of the hand we got dealt, you know, and it's something that we just need to learn to manage as best we can over time. In my day job, among the things I do in the School of Public Affairs at the University of Colorado is I teach a program in disaster management, as well as one in environmental policy. In the disaster research literature, there's a phenomenon called crowd surge disasters. And crowd surges happen either when there are a lot of people trying to get out of a confined space in a hurry, or just as often trying very hard to get into a space. Okay. And so crowd surge disasters then occur when there is a sense of panic or loss of control, when people are either trying to get in or too many people trying to get in or get out of a place in a hurry. And then what happens after that is a certain amount of panic, and then there's a stampede and people get trampled and killed or simply crushed and suffocated. One of the events at which deadly crowd surges sometimes occur is during the holiday shopping season. Just for fun, when you're going through all the ads, you know, in the newspapers between now and sometime after the first of the year, count how many times you see the word doorbusters. Okay. And of course, what that refers to is a surge of people so eager to get into a store at opening time that they literally break down the door in order to do so. 2 years ago, a security guard was trampled to death in one of these events. What usually brings them about is when one of these kind of big box department stores has a finite number of some item that's particularly sought after that holiday season, okay. And so they have a finite number of them, they mark down the price, okay. And so everybody who really wants that item, but who could otherwise not afford it, shows up at these things. It's usually stores that are in fairly moderate income parts of town. And again, the people who are trying to get in are the ones who couldn't otherwise afford that gift. Okay. And so when these things happen and these crowd surges occur and the doors are broken open and people are injured or on occasion killed, and then okay, the news media loves these, you know, they go in there and they show footage of people having fist fights over, you know, it's a doll or a video game or whatever it is that they feel they've really got to have, you know, an interesting way to celebrate the birth of the Prince of Peace. But it's a real media spectacle, right? And again, it's usually in neighborhoods where people don't have a lot of money and where they're, you know, a pair of, you know, the latest pair of shoes or whatever it is, and are desperate to get this thing that they want that they otherwise couldn't afford because of the frenzy of desire that has been built up leading up to that event. So, and then all too often, if it's not this kind of spectacle, it seems like the only other measure that the media has for deciding whether or not the holiday has been a success, whatever that is how much money was spent, you know, how much was consumed, right? So, I mean, there's, you know, the subtitle, and Luke is asking me about a title for this, you know, the Brahmavars and the Kalesis, why suffered in the virtues of rage, apathy, and gallows humor. You know, I mean, there is a certain element of this that is, I mean, it's dark and it's sad and it's also just bizarre, and in some ways, I mean, there is a weird kind of humor about it, right? Look what we've done, you know, in the midst of trying to celebrate a holiday that is supposed to be about gratitude and generosity and, you know, these virtues, and instead something very, very, very sad, very unfortunate has happened. I was also really struck this last election cycle by the power of hate that seemed to be unleashed, you know, in political discourse. You know, since the ancient Greeks, you know, these kind of the three perennial questions of politics and policy is, you know, what are the purposes and functions we want government to fulfill? How should those purposes be fulfilled? And how should the power to answer the first two questions be distributed? You know, we've been having that conversation for over 3,000 years. Since before we were a country, we were having a robust discourse on those same issues. You know, whether we want a large, powerful, centralized government that's capable of accomplishing all kinds of things, or whether we really want a small, limited one that carries out a very finite number of functions. That's part of the warp and woof of the American democratic process, right? And that gets played out, you know, in policy discourse and certainly at election time. Having differences on that, you know, one set of views mostly is aligned with Republicans and the other Democrats or liberals and conservatives, is different from electing somebody to lead the government who literally hates the government and is very intent upon simply doing everything possible to make the government as dysfunctional as possible. You know, some of the pundits who are looking at, you know, whether or not the newly elected majorities in the House and Senate are going to be capable of governing responsibly or, you know, providing genuine leadership, and the view seems to be that a lot depends on not so much on dialogue between, or, you know, relations between Democrats and Republicans as it does within the Republican Party itself. in terms of there being one faction that really realizes that this is finally their best shot, and then if they want to be able to maintain a majority and be the controlling party for a while, they have to demonstrate the capability of governing responsibly, you know, coming up with policies that can get a certain amount of support, whether or not we all happen to like them or not. And then there's this other wing who seems to have been elected because they literally, viscerally hate the President of the United States. And their goal is to absolutely destroy whatever vestiges of a legacy he may have created while he was here. And they don't have much of a goal beyond that. And to the extent that politics and political discourse is driven by that, we're doomed. Or at least insofar as, you know, our ability to get much done is concerned. And for me, that needs to be called out. You know, not pointing an accusatory finger at one faction or one party, but saying, what is our base intention? What are our real goals, you know, as members of this society? You know, how would we ideally like to see ourselves governed, whoever happens to be the majority party? You know? More than anything else, just to call out hate. You know, if that's indeed what's going on, you know, that's not a very good basis for governing a country. You know, Dan Shore back in 1995 said, well, you know, and Newt Gingrich, you know, with his contract with America, he said, you know, when you elect people to government who hate government, you don't usually get good government. So whatever your views on the power of government, at least to have some modicum or some threshold level of faith in the importance of government is kind of important. And again, I think that's something that if we can't at least coalesce around that, you know, we don't have a very bright future before us. And then on to delusion, of course. And staying in a political vein, the highest ranking unequivocal climate change denier in American politics is Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, who is about to become chairman of the Senate Environment and Resources Committee. So at least in the short term right now, it seems as if the U.S. is about to abandon its ability to play any form of leadership role in slowing and stopping climate change. And that's just how it seems to be playing itself out right now. And Buddhist Circle's working on climate change and other environmental conservation issues. It's acknowledged that it's, to begin with, in order to do this work at all, it's important to do three things. First is to give voice to the despair and the sadness and the sense of a felt need to withdraw, just to insulate oneself, and then to connect with each other, others who are feeling the same way, and then to figure out how to engage in wise action and non-dual discourse. I think sometimes, though, we don't give enough importance to the first step. And that's not to just give voice to despair, but also to rage and disgust and to a felt sense that it's just not right for one set of interest groups to walk away with our future, you know? Like Pluto says in Animal House, it's not over till we say it is. It's just that this isn't necessarily a time when we're going to be able to look forward to, I think, effective leadership at the federal government level, at any rate, to try to achieve some environmental protection objectives. So, some practice solutions. Okay, I have, you know, I don't think that there's any aspect of my discourse this evening that could be even charitably called non-dual. I basically just, you know, more than anything else, just kind of exemplified what's on my mind, but it's for a purpose. I think in order to, on the one hand, get this stuff out of our system, whatever it is that's really most heavily on our minds, before being able to genuinely reground ourselves in the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas, and to truthfully and honestly and openly engage in non-dual discourse, there needs to be a way to kind of purge yourself a little bit. And I think there are probably different ways you can do this. One is to find a non-dharma group where no one knows who you are and even that you sit, and use that venue to rant, rave, carry on, and you know, discharge all the kinds of thoughts and views that you might not otherwise. The other, and I think it's probably a little more constructive, is to get together with some dharma buddies and throw an unskillful speech party. And this is an environment that you deliberately set up with other people who you know, like yourself, are their working edge is right speech, right? That you understand the importance of guarding one's speech and of making a constructive contribution, and the understanding that the only way out of this is not more dualistic discourse and confrontation, all that good stuff, yada yada, right, okay. But in the meantime, you set aside a time where you just get together and spell it, you know, and you can do it almost like kabuki theater, you know, just personify that part of you whom this stuff is driving crazy, right? And just give it words, give expression to it in a safe environment with other Dharma friends. I do this every time I go out to the Bay Area, get together with, you know, old friends going back 30 years, you know, sat all over the place together, many of whom teach now, right? And we just go up one side and down the other and engage in every known form of unskillful speech, whether it's politics or anyone else we don't like for whatever reason. And it feels great. You know, not because it necessarily advances our practice any, but just gets it out of our system, right? Acknowledges that it's there, it acknowledges that it's part of what's going on. You know, my wife asked me why. Do you really need to tell this story that I'm about to tell? I said, well, you know, I kind of think maybe I do. You know, we have a friendly, pretty friendly neighborhood where I live, and every once in a while, you know, one of the neighbors throws a kind of a block party, and they invite everybody over, and we're all on good speaking terms and whatnot. And the family in the house directly across from us, They're friendly and kind of outgoing and whatnot. They're also kind of rowdy. And there have been a couple times when things seem to have gotten a lot of hand. I've gotten to talk to them and they're cool with it. Well, on Halloween, they held a party that went on way into the evening, and they had a speaker in an upstairs window that was pointed across the street. It was blaring out really loud music. And so long about midnight, after unsuccessful efforts to go to sleep for an hour or so, I just went over there and said, hey, you know, it's late, it's after midnight, you know, city of Denver, noise ordinance, 10 p.m. curfew, turn the music down. So, oh yeah, I'm so I left, and about 15 minutes later, nothing happened, I called the cops on them, right? And so very soon after that, it got very quiet. And it may be very quiet around our neighborhood for some time to come. You know, there are karmic consequences accruing when you do something like that, you know. And I knew it when I did it. And I had this, you know, I was working against this image of myself, you know, the image that, you know, sometimes my wife says, oh, Mr. Dharma, you know. So I had this kind of Mr. Dharma image of myself. I was chill, I was cool, it was okay, you know, they're having a good time, I should enjoy the, you know, the joy they're having. After a while, I was, I don't think so, you know. I realized I hit my limit, and I had to do something else, right? When I was just finishing my seminary program, in fact, there was this set of teaching precepts that we took, some of whom are actually, some of which are actually based on the Buddha's instructions to those going forth to teach, who he trained, you know. I vow to be present for suffering and the end of suffering. I vow to teach a graduated discourse, teach with clarity and simplicity. Okay. Vow to teach with compassion and open-heartedness. I vow not to disparage myself or others. And I vow to teach from a spirit of generosity while respecting my limitations. And in some ways, that last phrase has turned out over time for me to be a real saving grace, because it's kind of the ripcord on perfectionism. You know, it's acknowledging going in that we've all got our limits, and that it's really worth knowing, and not that they're always going to be at the same place, but it's really worth knowing where they are at any given point in time, because it allows you to know yourself a little better, and it helps relax that tension between the image that we sometimes create of who we think we ought to be as a good yogi and who, in fact, we really are. The true dharma of our being, who at the very base we fully understand ourselves to be in the moment. And not only understand, but accept. And the acceptance, of course, includes the acceptance of whoever shows up in the guest house. Please, any thoughts or reflections or questions about anything I've said?
Could you repeat the last vows that you said just now?
Yes.
I'd really like to hear them again.
Yes, and the reason that I find them useful is because I don't think they're just for people who presume to take the Dharma seed every now and then. I think that, you know, and I was kind of kidding about going someplace and running your mouth and, you know, unskillfully in other organizations. That's probably not such a great idea. Unskillful speech party, however, I think that could be a kick. That could be a lot of fun. So, because, like it or not, any of us who study the Dharma and practice the Dharma, and are among people who know that we do, okay, to a much greater extent than we might wish, we're teaching by example. So in that way, with our simple open-hearted willingness to share the Dharma with anyone who's genuinely interested, I think these precepts are equally applicable. You know. Vow to be present for suffering and the end of suffering. It's an important one because too often, without even knowing it, we choose not to be present for suffering, whether it's our own or somebody else's. You know, just kind of look the other way or agree to not see that which is waiting to be seen. So I agree to be present for suffering and the end of suffering, right? And that's the realization of the Third Noble Truth. Yes, it is possible for suffering to cease. So the first one, vow to be present for suffering and the end of suffering. Secondly, the Buddha said, I shall teach a graduated discourse. By that he meant to start simply and keep to the basics and just understand that the more simply a message can be conveyed, the more likely it is to be understood. But that, as one goes on and explores the Dharma more deeply, there is much more to be found there. Okay, so vowing to teach with clarity and simplicity, that's what that one means. Teaching with compassion, loving kindness. I mean, that's the core motivation for sharing the Dharma anywhere and under any circumstances. Because to do otherwise is to begin to proselytize a little bit, to kind of push your point of view a little. But if you're coming from a genuine place of wanting to help another to learn how to alleviate their suffering, then we know from our own experience it's not skillfully done by trying to convince somebody that they ought to do it a certain way, but simply offering something and seeing if it's taken in or not. Teaching without disparaging oneself or others. Okay. And to avoid comparing and the kind of sectarianism that can come from doing that. Okay. I'm fairly self-disclosive, and sometimes I'm somewhat self-disparaging, but it's for a purpose. It's my self-antidote against perfectionism, actually. And that can be useful too, as long as you don't get carried away with it. And vowing to teach or to share the Dharma from a place of generosity while respecting my own limitations. Okay. Till you've reached the fourth stage of enlightenment, there shall be limitations. It's just kind of how it is, you know. And to accept that with a certain amount of equanimity and whatnot is a useful thing.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. That's what keeps us from, I think, letting the despair get the best of us. There's a couple of years ago, and I was on sabbatical in Australia, National Museum in Sydney. It's a whole wing of the art museum that's devoted to Aboriginal art. Just gorgeous, stunning stuff. And over the last generation or so, Australia has gone through this very painful process of healing and reconciliation between the dominant government and the dominant Anglo culture in the Aboriginal populations. And it's a really stepwise process of conciliation, almost like in South Africa, but it's really moving along, and it's being tended with as much care as is possible on all sides. And yet at the same time, there is this really very deep-seated sense of woundedness that is still needing to be attended to, and some really powerful, powerful aversive emotions on everyone's part, especially the Aborigines. And part of the reconciliation process is from a felt understanding that really deep-seated feeling of resentment, whether on one side or the other, is what is keeping the nation from being whole again. And so, with embedded in one of these pieces of art is this poem that is expressive of, I think, a sort of ancient Aboriginal figure, ghost figure. Says, "In the desert I saw a creature, naked, bestial, who squatting upon the ground, held his heart in his hands and ate of it. I said, is it good, friend? It is bitter. Bitter, he answered, but I like it because it is bitter and because it is my heart." That's what happens when you let the despair get the better of you. And the way to avoid that, one of the ways to avoid that, is what I was just talking about here. Is that when the seeds of despair begin to arise, you know, or rage or revulsion or whatever it is, to be able to identify them, to see them for what they are, and to give them voice in their nascent stages within the place of refuge or sanctuary of your own practice. It's kind of like homeopathic medicine, to the extent I understand it, which is, you know, where you give a little bit of something that is potentially toxic or threatening to the body, but just enough so that it builds a resistance to it and strengthens the body's capability to keep itself healthy. Same with this, right? If you can recognize it at the beginning, if you can call it forth, if you can shine light on it, then it keeps it from having the destructive force that it might otherwise. Let's sit for just a minute, please. May we live with ease, safe from all inner and outer harm. May we recognize any physical and mental afflictions that we may carry and hold them with compassion and caring and kindness. May we rest in silence and stillness. May we rest in generosity and kindness of heart. May we awaken and be free. Have a good week, everybody.
Thank you.